nostalgia is all the craze again, but instead of going back to the baby boomers 50s and 60s baseball, now it's time to start concentrating on baseball in the 70s. New book's coming out later this month by Dan Epstein. It's called Big Hair and Plastic Grass, A Funky Ride Through Baseball in America in the Swinging 70s. And I'm glad Dan has a few minutes to chat with us this afternoon. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Ron. Thanks for having me.
Oh, great book. Great book. Congratulations.
Thank you.
As a member of the slightly post-baby boomer generation, these were the players and games of my youth. And it's really refreshing to see. I don't think there's been much written about this era yet. And why don't you tell us a little bit about why this is so important to you?
Well, to tell you the truth, I mean, one of the reasons I started writing the book in the first place was because there had been so little written. I was going through a period of just, I guess, kind of getting back into exploring baseball history, and the 70s were the decade where I fell in love with the sport in the first place, and I thought, well, wouldn't it be cool to go back and read about Mark Friedrich and Bill Bee and Doc Ellis and all those cats, and, you know, and maybe just, like, gain a broader understanding of the era. And try as I might, I actually couldn't find very much that had been written about them other than, you know, the player's own autobiographies. And so I decided that what I wanted to do was kind of take a year-by-year look at the game during the 70s and all the many changes that the sport went through during that period, but also try to weave in stories about the players and, you know, the sort of unique characters of the era.
And as I'm thumbing through the book, I see that the intermittent chapters have to deal with the transformation of the ball fields themselves, the uniforms, the hair.
Yes.
That's part of the book's title is The Big Hair, and there's this great picture of Oscar Gamble with the world's biggest fro on the cover. A marked difference, I must say, than what he looks like right now. But
yes.
That was the era when pretty much, just like the rest of America, youth was breaking out from conservative norms and experimenting, rebelling, so to speak. And this looks like a fun book to put together.
Yeah, it really was. And I mean, you know, when you talk about youth rebelling, I mean, I think we have this sort of, I don't know if stereotype's the right word, but we have this, the standard line is that, you know, the youth of America rebelled during the 60s, and, you know, and that was all then, and then it's, you know, 70s was, you know, more conformity and, you know, disco fashions or what have you. But I think all of that sort of upheaval that went on in America in the 1960s didn't really hit baseball until a few years later. And that's kind of one of the interesting things, you know, to go back. And when I was researching the book to see just like how that kind of, sense of nonconformity, you know, was popping up in baseball in the 70s in ways that, you know, may have been even kind of passe to the rest of America by that time.
You talk about rebelling. You have teams like the Yankees and George Steinbrenner, who steadfastly refused to let the Yankees grow beards and have hair past a certain length. You have the Cincinnati Reds, who had an absolute no facial hair policy.
Right.
Then you have someone like Charlie Finley, who encouraged his players to go bushy.
Right. And, of course, I mean, which seems kind of like a visionary move now, but it was actually one of Finley's many attempts to bring down his star player, Reggie Jackson. Jackson had shown up to training camp in 72 with a full beard, you know, sort of as a way of asserting his individuality. And Finley thought it would take him down a few pegs if he got everybody else on the team to grow facial hair, thereby making Jackson less of a, you know, less of a target for attention. And so he offered all the players on the team, I believe it was $300 to grow a mustache. And the great Raleigh Fingers quote was, "I would grow a mustache on my ass for $300." And it sort of backfired because, at least in the sense that it didn't really do much to take Jackson down a peg. I don't think anything could have taken Reggie Jackson down a peg. But it also, you know, what started is just sort of, you know, Machiavellian behind the scenes move turned into really something that resonated with the fans and the players. It was one of those superstitious baseball things where they shaved all their mustaches off after the mustache day that Finley had planned, and they started slumping. And so, of course, it's like, well, let's grow the mustaches back because we were playing better while we had the mustaches on. And from there, it became sort of, you know, they became a symbol of, you know, sort of the swinging American youth, even though a lot of the players on the team were actually pretty conservative. But when they played the Reds in the 72 World Series, it was billed as the Hares versus Squares World Series because, of course, the A's were supposed to, you know, look very radical in comparison to their counterparts from Cincinnati.
Now, what was that confrontation in that series, an actual mindset, or were the members of the Reds really that straight arrowish that they saw it as us against the nonconformists, or they were just young guys anyway who were just like doing their job and listening to the rules?
Yeah, I think it was really more a case of the latter. I think I'm sure if they had been there were a few players on the team who I'm sure on the Reds team, that is, who I'm sure would have grown mustaches if they'd been allowed to. But for the most part, I think it was the same as with the A's. There were players who probably wouldn't have grown mustaches if there hadn't been cash incentive to do so.
Mm-hmm. When you're doing the research for your book, like you say, there really hasn't been much written on this era. What were the main sources of your research?
I've tried to get my hands on every player autobiography that came out during, during the 70s or during the 80s by a player who had played in the 70s, as well as everything from Roger Angel's Five Seasons, which to me is still like the ultimate book on the period, even though it just really tackled the first half of the decade. And then just like wading into, you know, stacks and stacks of the Sporting News, Sports Illustrated, Sport Magazine, pretty much, there really isn't that much available even on YouTube because most of the games weren't televised back then. And those that were didn't make the cut in the network archives. So it was difficult. It probably took me the better part of 3 or 4 years to do all the research on this. And thankfully, with the internet, there were it's a lot easier to access old copies of the Sporting News and Sports Illustrated.
It's interesting because if my understanding is correct, the Sporting News is a very conservative publication.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Sports Illustrated seemed kind of swinging and radical by comparison, but you would just find there'd just be these little details in the pages of the Sporting News that you wouldn't get in Sports Illustrated. Even just little sort of tidbits about bars that players owned, or you'd see advertisements for games, board games, or just things that even if it didn't make it into the book, just kind of gave me a greater sense of what, day-to-day baseball culture was in the 70s.
What was Jim Palmer modeling underwear at that point?
This is an interesting question. I obviously I remember those ads, but I doing a Jim Palmer underwear search on the internet.
So that's going to print up.
So I was never actually able to ascertain when he started doing those ads. So I could not tell you with certainty that these began in the 70s. I know he was doing them in the early 80s, but and it's entirely possible he was doing them in the 70s, but I just couldn't find any corroboration.
I want to play a little game here now. It's kind of like word association, but it's going to be year association. I'll give you the year, and you tell me the first event or personality or trend that pops into your head.
Great.
We'll go in chronological order, so let's start with 1970.
I'm going to say, I'm going to draw a blank is what I'm going
to do. It might have been one of those cusp years where it's still getting over the 60s and there's nothing really sticking out to make it a year of its own.
I would say, you know, the Baltimore Orioles winning the World Series, Brooks Robinson making all those amazing stabs at third base. That would be the first thing that comes to my mind. I believe that was also the first year that was the first year that the Reds played at Riverfront, which was, of course, one of the many ashtray-shaped, AstroTurf-covered baseball fields that sprang up during the 70s.
At one point in your book, you talk about the mandatory use of helmets, and I always found it fascinating that Robinson was the only one who had that little bill on his batting helmet.
Right, and he sawed it off. He basically customized it himself because he felt that somehow the extra length on the bill interfered with his batting eye.
It's amazing. It didn't seem to bother anybody else, all the other players, but you can't argue with the success he had.
Exactly.
All right, 1971.
1971, got to go got to go with the Pittsburgh Pirates. That was the year they won the World Series. That was the year Clemente kind of got a chance to finally strut his stuff before a national televised audience during the World Series, and sort of proved to the world that he was actually one of the all-time greats, as opposed to this sort of moody inscrutable Latino ball player that the media had painted him as.
Okay, 72.
72. 72. We've got that. Well, that's the mustache gang. That's Oakland A's all sprouting mustaches at the behest of Charlie Finley, and the Hair versus Squares World Series against the Reds.
Okay, and 73.
73 would be. The first thing that comes to mind, unfortunately, is Willie Mays playing out his career with the Mets, and such an amazing ball player, just a few years past the sell by date, and it was a beautiful thing that he got to come back to New York and go to the World Series with the Mets. But he really, was just a shadow of his former self by that point.
Okay, 1974.
74 would be... 74, well, that's sort of the first great version of the LA Dodgers, the Ron Say, Bill Russell, David Lopes, Steve Garvey infield, going to the World Series, losing to the A's, and of course the big story on the Dodgers that year was Mike Marshall, who was this talk about one of the more interesting characters from this decade. This was a guy who was professor of kinesiology at Michigan State, and really kind of looked at baseball as sort of like one big experimental one big experiment, and he was sort of he was the main subject of the experiment, just seeing how often he could pitch without rest. He often often pitched relief, several days in a row with no rest, many times three or more innings. Won the Cy Young Award, pitched over 200 innings as a reliever, won, I believe, 14 games that season, and just, pretty much went against all conventional wisdom as to how relief pitchers should be used.
And that's amazing when you think of the way bullpens are used today, where you have the left-handed one-out specialist come in.
Right.
We can have routinely 5-6 pitchers during the course of one game, and where a quality start is considered a starting pitcher who leaves the game with a 4.5 ERA.
Right.
It's just amazing it seems like he has a lot he could teach the modern pitching staffs today.
Yeah, unfortunately, he kind of broke down a few years later, which I don't, it's debatable whether or not it had to do with his workload, but it sort of, lent credence to the idea that, he was out of his mind. But I think actually a little known fact is that Tommy John, of the famous Tommy John surgery, when he came back from that surgery, which was extremely radical for the time, Mike Marshall was the guy who kind of walked him through his rehab. And it wasn't, wasn't as a doctor-patient thing. It was just sort of like as a friend, and Marshall saying, okay, here's what you need to do, and these are the exercises you need to do. And Tommy John came back and had an amazing career.
It certainly worked for him.